Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Jack Watt for Jack Watt's Live, broadcasting from Midtown Atlanta, from the We Believe America Tower, overlooking majestic Buckhead. Today we have a very special guest, and as I am waiting for him, I am going to tell you just a little bit about my second radio show, and that's Jack Watts on Recovery. This Jack Watts Live is political, and it broadcasts on Monday afternoon from 5:30 to 6 Eastern. And it is available on the archives, on Blog Talk Radio, any place you want to find it, at any time you want to listen to it. The second show on recovery is about just that. It's specifically based on recovery from religious abuse, but it is also something that people who are recovering from alcoholism, from drug addiction, from codependency, from abuse in marriage, any kind of domestic violence, things of that nature can call in because I've written about all of it. I do a daily blog called Pushing Jesus. And when I started it 5 years ago, I would spend 2 or 3 hours sometimes going over the material and writing these really tight recovery blogs. And 2 or 3 people would look at them. And I'd say to myself, I know I'm supposed to be doing this, but why isn't anybody paying much attention? Well, I wrote a book, Recovering from Religious Abuse, 11 Steps to Spiritual Freedom. And the 11 steps are the key to all of the recovery material. It was published by Simon & Schuster, and that helped me a good deal in getting some of the material out. Now, in the last 3 months, people from 65 different countries have looked at the material that I have on my blog, Pushing Jesus. If you Google Pushing Jesus, Jack Watts will come right up, and we will just have all kinds of stuff with that. All right. Now, let me just continue here a little bit. It looks to me like my guest is a little late, which, of course, is never the best thing when you are on live radio. That being the case, let me just continue a little bit about my reason for doing the Jack Watts Live program. I remember when I was just little more than a kid, at least emotionally. I was an adult, but definitely a kid. And I would look at the news a little bit, and I would believe what was said to me, and, da-da-da-da-da-da. We got into the Vietnam War. I was drafted, and I had my orders to go overseas. To go to Fort Dix, New Jersey, with a letter. You are hereby commanded to report to Fort Dix, New Jersey. Well, guys when they're 18 and 19 don't have to face that anymore. But my generation, everybody faced it. As it turned out, I was married and my wife was pregnant, and I went from 1A to 3A in the draft cycle, which means that they would take all of the A's and all of the ones and all of the twos before they would take threes, because they didn't want somebody to die who had dependents, because they didn't have to pay for them forever, which, you know, in my case, it would have been a long time. And so I was spared going to Vietnam. Nevertheless, when all of the protests were raging all over America, I moved my small family out to Isla Vista, a radical hippie community adjacent to the University of California, Santa Barbara, in Southern California, where there were protests against the war almost daily. In fact, this is where the hippies burned the Bank of America to the ground, and the National Guard was called out and shot them with rubber bullets. It was quite an affair. I was pretty conservative. I was a Christian, and Nixon was president at that time. I voted for him in 1968, my first time ever able to vote, and voted for him again in 1972. When he turned out to be a crook, when he was responsible for the cover-up of the Watergate break-in, and it came to light, it was news every night, something about Watergate. It was there all the time. I remember thinking, our nation has been spared because people from the left-wing media, Woodward and Bernstein, kept at it and got to the truth and revealed it. And I had to admit to myself that I was on the wrong side, that I was on the side of the cover-up. And I made a determination right then and there that that would never happen again. Well, Gerald Ford took over for Nixon, who resigned in disgrace. When Ford ran in 1976, Jimmy Carter came along, and he promised hope and change. And he had that toothy grin, and I voted for him. I voted for Jimmy Carter in 1976 and soon learned that he was absolutely not the person that he claimed to be. Now, I felt like a fool again. With that in mind, I said, I just don't know enough. And I decided to go back to graduate school. I was tired of people telling me things and me having to just believe it or not believe it. I wanted to know for myself. So I went to Baylor and received a master's degree in what they call church state studies. It is a very unusual degree. There are probably 50 people in America that have ever had it. From there, I went on to Emory and worked on a PhD in international politics, minoring in political theory and nuclear strategy. As I was nearing the end of it, and all I had to do was finish the dissertation, there were family troubles, and I never ended up completing it. Nevertheless, I did has the basis of knowledge to do the things necessary to think for myself and come up with my own answers to questions. So what did I do? I worked for a Republican who was running for Congress whose best friend was Jake Garn. He was the senator of the banking committee, chairman of the banking committee, because at that time Ronald Reagan won in 1980, and I voted for him and did everything I could to get Jimmy Carter out of office because he got in, dismantled the military, the prices of everything went up, interest rates went up, our prestige in the world declined. He made a complete mess of this nation, and anybody who was an adult during that time will tell you the same thing. All right. So I start working for a Republican who's trying to unseat Elliot Leviticus, who is the congressman from the 4th District over in the DeKalb area and in Atlanta. Now, because my candidate was Jake Garn's best friend, and he was one of the most powerful senators in Washington as the Reagan Revolution was beginning, when I would go to Washington to raise money from the political action committees, which I did several times, I actually stayed at Jake Garn's house with his family and was able to eat in the Senate dining room. I remember sitting at a table next to Liv Ullmann when she was young and beautiful, and Hope Wang, who played in The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, and they were having lunch with Senator Scoop Jackson from Washington. And I need to tell you, I felt like I was all that and a bag of chips. At any rate, one of the big political operatives at the time was a fellow named Lee Atwater. He came through George Herbert Walker Bush, but he worked for the Reagan team once Bush became the vice presidential nominee, and he was kind of a dirty tricks kind of guy. That's what he is best known for. At any rate, I pulled, was called and went into his office for a meeting, and he sat there, and there were two men that were there just before me, and honest to goodness, they looked like characters from a John Grisham novel. They were just scruffy and looked like they, you know, really were just about needed to go to detox. It was I was just surprised to see them because everybody was so sharp in the White House and in the building next to it, which is where Lee Atwater's office was, the gray one, the vice presidential place. At any rate, so I sat down with Lee Atwater, and he said, "You know who those two were?" And I shook my head because I had no idea. And he said, "They were in charge of shadowing Jimmy Carter during the 1980 presidential race. Their job, they were certain that Jimmy Carter was having an affair with somebody, and their job was to try and catch him. And they had a name that they thought it was, so they just, you know, did everything that they could to harass the president. And when he told me this, he was proud of it.
And he thought that I would be too. Was shocked. I didn't believe it. Not a word of it. And even if it was true, I didn't want any part of it. I didn't like all of the discord. I didn't like the I've gotcha kind of mentality. I didn't like any of it. When I left the office, I was out of politics. I said, I do not ever want to be working for any of these people again. I do not want my career, my life, to be something that is that reprehensible, to be involved with those kind of people. It was not Jack Watt. I finished the job that I'd been tasked to do, our candidate law. When I was done, I left. There I was, trained for politics, but I didn't want to be in it. Ultimately, I started working for a Christian ministry, Walk Through the Bible, which was involved with publishing and with marketing. And it did that and have continued to do that for the remainder of my career. Nevertheless, my whole idea of wanting to know the truth, of wanting to present the truth, of wanting to help people understand exactly what is going on so that they can form their own opinion is exactly what I have done for the remainder of my career. When Barack Obama ran for office in 2008, I had no misgivings. I knew he was bad news. I knew that he was not who he said he was. It was like with Jimmy Carter, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So I was not one of the people who drank the Kool-Aid. Never did I even once consider that he was going to be a good president. To begin with, he wasn't qualified. And as we have learned as we've been doing this program, there are things about him that just don't add up. Finally, he's being vetted thoroughly, as he should have been the first time. The reason he wasn't, in my estimation, is that, well, you're just you know, against black people. You're just a racist if you question Barack Obama in any way. So people didn't. They really gave him a pass when they shouldn't have, when they certainly didn't give Hillary Clinton a pass, and they certainly didn't give John McCain a pass. So once he got into office and started his mismanagement, overspending, having no budget, making us more dependent on foreign oil, bowing to the Saudi king, saying he's the best friend that Israel ever had, while secretly undermining them at every juncture, I knew that I needed to do some things, anything I could do to tell the American people of what was going on. And yet I wanted to do so in a way that wasn't like some of these conservative right-wing talk show hosts who, number one, don't have the academic background that I do, but also just not nice. I don't like calling people names. I don't like it when people call me names. And he is our president. He's my president.
the office of the presidency deserves some respect. And for that reason and that reason only, we try to be pretty kind to President Obama as far as like not making ad hominem remarks about him. At the same time, one of the in the political theory classes that I had in graduate school at both Baylor and at Emory, I remember that quote from Lord Acton where he said, "The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing." I made a determination that I would not be somebody who would do nothing. Consequently, I wrote a book that I co-authored with David Dunham called We Believe, 30 Days to Understanding Our Heritage. About the book, Judge Andrew Napolitano, who's the analyst there on Fox News, said, "We live in a time when most Americans are ignorant of history and have little understanding of their rich heritage. The classic warning by the 19th century philosopher George Santa Anna rings true today. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And we believe the authors have taken the key documents upon which our country was founded, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, and others, and have made understanding our heritage succinct and to the point." Well, that's what our purpose was in writing the book, We Believe. We wanted to have something where people could take 10 minutes a day for a month and get a pretty solid knowledge and foundation about our heritage. So I wrote the book, put brief excerpts of primary documents. When I say primary documents, that means the Constitution itself is in the book in its entirety, and then brief excerpts from other parts of documents from our history, and just went about and did everything that we could to just give people a great flavor of what our country stands for, of who we are, of what our values are, and how we have drifted from them to the point where we don't even recognize what they are. So we put things in there like the speech from Patrick Henry, "Give me liberty or give me death." We put the words to the Star Spangled Banner, not just the first stanza, but all the rest of them. Interestingly, we put in the Declaration of Independence, obviously, and Kennedy's inaugural address, where he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." President Kennedy was a Democrat. He'd be a pretty conservative Republican at this juncture, 50 years later. But he understood that it was important to do something for your country and not just be someone who is always, "What are you going to do for me next?" Self-reliant himself, as well as the rest of his family, that part of his inaugural address has remained an important part of our history. We put in the Truman Doctrine, which was absolutely the thing that saved Western Europe from communism at the end of World War II. We put in the Federalist Papers, Federalist 10. We put in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream. We wanted to give the complete flavor of what our nation was all about, to help people gain the values that made America great, which comes from the Puritan work ethic, straight from John Winthrop and the Massachusetts Bay Colony, when it was founded as a city upon a hill for the entire world to look at. These principled men and women came over. They wanted freedom of religion. They insisted upon freedom of religion. It has been the bedrock of who we are as a nation. That's freedom to believe the way you want to believe. It is now turned into governmental enmity towards people of faith. Currently, the Obama administration, they like to say that there's a war on women, which is a ruse and not true, but there is a war on people of faith by having the mandate for abortion in Obamacare and insisting the Catholic institutions abide by it. They are telling these people that their faith is not something that's important, while at the same time, in Obamacare, the Muslims don't have to participate because of their religious concept that is called dhimmitude. In dhimmitude, they think that participating in universal health care is like a lottery, and so it's gambling, which is sinful to them, so they don't have to participate, but we have to pay for them. So the Obama administration, in this instance, is pro-Islam and anti-Catholic. And they think there's nothing wrong with that and that they aren't going to pay a price for it. I suspect that they will. These are the kinds of things from the time I was young and I saw the deceitfulness in government that I said, I will pay attention to this and I will not sit by and see the country deteriorate because of unscrupulous men and women in high places. And that is what I see. We have a president, in my estimation, who is extraordinarily corrupt. He looks good. He presents well. He's charming. He's articulate. But he has a worldview that is absolutely opposed to the fundamental beliefs of our founding fathers. That's why We Believe is such an important book, in my estimation. By the way, if you want a free download of it, you can go to my website, Jack Watts, www.jackwatts.me, and get a free download, which with my pleasure, to help you understand better who we are. Even though my guest didn't show, I'm glad that I got a chance to tell you a little bit more about who I am and why I am doing the things that I'm doing. And I want to just say this. God love you, and God bless the United States of America, and we will prevail.